Hi, you're listening to Stefan Levera Podcast, a show about Bitcoin and Austrian economics brought to you by Swan.com. Have you considered using eSIMs instead of the typical telco mobile phone SIM? Silent.link joins me to talk about eSIMs for privacy and convenience. The lead sponsor of this show is Swan Bitcoin, and Swan is organizing Pacific Bitcoin again. Yes, it's happening again. It was a phenomenal experience last year. The feedback that I was hearing from people is that it was the perfect mix of awesome speakers and a great vibe with awesome people that you could meet and connect with, as well as learn from various people in the Bitcoin ecosystem, whether they are speakers or just fellow Bitcoiners who are there that you can network and chat with. So for those of you in or near LA, this is a must go and must do for you. You have to come along, make sure you bring a friend or some family members along, because this is the perfect environment for them to see that this is real, that there are real Bitcoiners who are out there trying to drive forward adoption and actually make the world a better place. Pacific Bitcoin is a phenomenal experience. I really hope to see you all there. I'll be there, of course, as one of the speakers, and I'm looking forward to seeing you there. There'll be a range of speakers. There'll be a range of stages that you can get involved with, and there'll be something for everybody, whether you are a new coiner, an intermediate coiner, or a long-time experienced Bitcoiner. Go to pacificbitcoin.com and use code Levera for a discount on your tickets before the price rises. It's October 5th and 6th in LA. CoinKite.com make an amazing range of hardware products to secure your Bitcoin and also accessories that you can use along with that. So for example, you need to think about your recovery and backups. So with ColdCard, they have the seed plate. So with the ColdCard, you might have your 12 or 24 word seed. With the seed plate, you can punch in the letters on that seed device, and this is in metal. So it's much harder to destroy. This way, you can help give yourself that peace of mind in case your house goes up on fire, or, you know, obviously not something you're planning for, but obviously this is something that you want to be prepared for, this scenario. So using a seed plate, you can back up your keys and make sure that you or your loved ones still have access if something were to happen to your hardware device. So go to coinkite.com, use code Levera for a discount on your cold cards, and you can find a range of other products there over at coinkite.com. On to the show with Silent.link. Silent.link, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having us.
So I've seen your service, and I've actually been playing around with using your service when I'm overseas as well. It's an interesting idea, and would like to chat a little bit about what you're doing, how it works, because I think some listeners might be interested to hear a little bit about it. So do you want to just give an overview? What is Silent.link? Just an overview of how it works as well.
Silent.link is a purely Bitcoin business. That is a branch of a traditional fiat company that is a reseller and MVNO of SIM and eSIM services. It was made as an experiment to try to adopt the changing market and kind of welcome the Bitcoin adoption in our field of activity.
Great. And as I understand, you have different service offerings. Can you just outline what those different service offerings are?
Our main service offerings are data-only accounts that allow you to access internet in more than 150 countries, wherever you go, automatically. And the rates are much lower than those for normal roaming services. Our other service is identity accounts that also, in addition to the data access, they offer a phone number from, now we have numbers from United States and from United Kingdom. You can register services like Signal, WhatsApp, and whatever to these numbers.
Yeah. And so can you give a rough idea of the prices so people get an idea there?
Pricing is very simple. The data-only eSIM costs $9, and it's a one-time fee. You pay it and you get $5 on your initial balance. Then you can spend this balance on data services, and you can top up as needed. Plans are pay as you go. There is no expiration. There are no hidden charges, no monthly payments, nothing like that. With identity plans, we require an annual fee of $59 for the US identity and about 59 pounds for UK identity to keep the number. If you do not wish to keep the number, you can just skip your annual payment and your account will just turn into a data-only account.
And so these services can be used like a throwaway service because basically the user can sign up without having to give any specific information. They just sign up, pay Bitcoin or Lightning. They get this eSIM and they can use it and then just throw it away when they're done with it if that's what they want to do. Or I guess on the other hand, you can refill it with Lightning as an example.
Yes, absolutely. The use case is completely up to the user. They can keep the number for a long time or they can just discard it when they do not need it. This differs us from the services that allow one-time activation. Those are specifically for throwaway accounts. Our is more like midterm. But by the way, we are going to roll out this throwaway service too, because we want to give our users all the options.
Ah, I see. Yeah. Okay. So it's not currently quite for the throwaway, although I guess you could use it like that. But that's something you're looking to have. Okay. And so, as you mentioned, the $9 and $59 are the initial cost to buy the product. And then in terms of the ongoing cost per megabyte used online, can you give a rough idea there? Is it somewhat comparable with local providers in those countries that the person is going to?
Yes, it's comparable. It will most likely be more expensive in most of the places, unless there are some exceptions maybe. Because definitely we can consider a local mobile services subsidized by the needs to surveil the population. So it's maybe even surprising that we still pay for mobile services.
That reminds me very much of the saying, well, it's like the cliche now, it's that if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. So in terms of main types of users, as I understand the service, it's useful for tourists in one case because they're traveling around and they just want to be able to quickly, or even business travelers, and then the privacy focus. So would you see those as the two main uses, or do you see any other particular use?
Yes, and actually for travelers, it's a much less expensive option than using the traditional roaming services, because our eSIMs were specifically made for traveling, and we offer very reasonable rates in almost all the countries, wherever it's at all possible. So it's actually quite good for traveling, and it saves you from the hassle of having to find a local SIM too.
Yeah, that can definitely save time, especially if you are just traveling through a country for a few days and you don't have time to get a local SIM in every country. But you also don't want to pay the high roaming fees that many people have with their home country provider. So that's something I've actually used. I've used Silent.link in different countries. Some countries I've had issues with using it, but others I've had a pretty good experience with it. So, for example, in the UK or the US, I think it's worked pretty smoothly for me. But in some other countries, I've had issues connecting to the service. But I think it's a good option to have just as a back pocket option. And so it's useful in that way. In terms of the speed of the service, like 4G, 5G, is it comparable there to what locals in those countries would be getting, or maybe just a bit slower? Or do you have a comment there around the speed of the data service?
Actually, roaming subscribers usually get a higher priority than local subscribers. So you could expect even better speeds. But some operators limit connections to like 4G, or sometimes they do not provide 5G. That this happens, and it's completely up to them. So, but it's rare, because actually local carriers are interested in you spending money in their network.
Gotcha. Yeah. So it's interesting then that you say that. Yeah, I think it makes total sense then that the roaming providers get roaming users rather get a better treatment than the normal paying customers, because the roaming people might be paying more. And so one other area that's interesting is that it depends on what country you're in, but with some countries, KYC or some form of identity verification is often required in order to get a local SIM. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on whether that is a trend we're going to continue seeing, or is it a trend that's on the up or the down? How are you seeing that if we look at different countries around the world?
Of course, it's a trend and it's up, but fortunately, it mostly exists on the retail level. It's a requirement for retailers to collect this information, pass it to the major operators, whereas for us, we are free to make our own policy on that.
I see. Yeah. And so it's not like what you're doing is illegal. It's just the rules are different for what you are offering than what for, let's say, a standard telco in the countries have to do.
What we do is totally legal. Hence, we operate for 3 years without any issues.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I mean, I think it offers a lot of options there for, especially for Bitcoin and Lightning users out there who just want an easy ability to use a service. And oftentimes, there are apps that people want to sign up and use that require an actual phone number identity and not just the data. So this is another way for people to get that, whether it's using Signal or WhatsApp, or sometimes if you're in a country and you need access to a service like a food delivery or a taxi app or something like this. That's probably another example where maybe if you don't already have that set up in your home country, then you're going to need the identity service at that point, right? To be able to sign up with that service.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. And so when it comes to, I guess, phone usage around the world and identity and surveillance, there was a recent news article, which I'm sure you probably saw or heard about this, where the French government wants the power to block social media and to tap into cell phones. So I'm curious if you saw this news article and if you have any reactions on this as a phone service provider.
As a telecom professional, I have to inform you that surveillance over mobile phones was always possible, and actually the functionality of eavesdropping to calls and even the surroundings of the phone were implemented since day one. And it's a strict requirement for any operator, like normal operator, to provide means for the law enforcement to tap into phone calls and to initiate phone calls from mobile phones of the users without them even knowing it. Not very well known information, but actually is the fact. And we are proud to say that we help our users in this regard, because if you have a local card, like you are in United States and you have an AT&T account, for example, it's pretty trivial for your adversary to perform this type of attack by leveraging their law enforcement or coercing people, finding the ways. But if you have a roaming account and you came from other country, it's absolutely unclear how to try to tap into your phone, because you need to leverage the operator that issued the eSIM, and at the moment it's not in the home network, so the surveillance capabilities are greatly diminished.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And so as you're saying, basically many people are already pwned from day one, because it's that relationship that the phone has with the telco, where the telco, as you're saying, can tap into the phone calls that are being made. And of course, you know, everyone's seen like the spy movies or whatever, and I'm sure it's like it's probably not that hard to tap into the phone calls being made just on the standard network. But I'm curious then, in terms of something like Signal calls as an example, is that so easy to tap into, or that's harder to tap into?
Well, it depends on to whom. For Signal, of course, it might be possible to tap into, we do not know, because their application is distributed as an binary encrypted, and we do not know what's installed in our phones. But as for the traditional surveillance capability, when you talk on WhatsApp or on Signal, the microphone on your device is busy, and for example, law enforcement or mobile provider cannot tap into your phone and listen through like legacy technologies while you are talking on Signal, for example, because your phone is physically busy with other call, and they need to establish a call from your device to either to tap into ongoing call or just listen to surroundings of the phone. Anyway, they need to initiate a call. So if your phone is busy at the moment, it's probably some kind of protection.
Oh, interesting. And as I'm aware that I know there are, for example, zero-day attacks that are out there and exploits that are sometimes published or, you know, found, and people get them on the darknet market. And sometimes governments and police and law enforcement will use those exploits even. And so, as I understand, some of those exploits can be based on getting a person to install something on their phone, and maybe others are more like they can be done remotely to somebody's phone. And so I guess that could be an opportunity for, whether that's law enforcement or somebody else, it could be done in a malicious way, or it could be done in like a law enforcement way, that they may be trying to use that exploit on a person to understand what's going on that phone. And so as an example, it may well be that Signal is end-to-end encrypted, or WhatsApp calls are end-to-end encrypted. As an example, if you are, you know, in some other country and you're using Signal or WhatsApp, and you might think, okay, the call's encrypted, but what if the device has been pwned? I guess that's probably one other area where, even if the call's encrypted, the device is pwned, and from there, whoever is trying to tap into the phone at that point can hear the call or see the text, right?
Sure, or the device of the person you are talking to, or any member of a group call, definitely. If you want to kind of attack a mobile user, you can attack either his device or the mobile network, or just the user himself, so that he installs an exploit to his device, then attack his device. Those are three main routes of attack.
Yeah. And so I'm curious if you have any thoughts on the main vectors for some of these exploits. So people who want to stay secure, what are the main things that they need to be careful about with exploits?
They would definitely need to minimize the number of apps they use, because definitely any app can introduce a vulnerability, even though in the modern mobile operating systems, apps work in sandbox, but sometimes there are 0 days in these sandboxes too. So if you really have operational security requirements, then you should be very, very picky about your hardware and how you use it and the software that runs on it. For example, you might want to explore Graphene OS. It's a de-googled Android, very popular among our users.
Yeah, I see. And so, as I understand, the Graphene OS team do a lot of things to try and harden the operating system, though imperfect, because nothing's perfect, but they harden the system against, I guess, attack, and it is a more secure way of using the phone. How much would you say that helps if, you know, as an example, if somebody is using Graphene OS, but they still use a standard phone SIM and they don't use silent.link eSIM or something like this, then they can still get their phone. Obviously, their phone calls can still be tapped by the provider or by law enforcement, right?
Well, big shout out to Graphene development team. They are doing absolutely incredible job, and they actually are giving us the only working option today to have a privacy phone. They mitigate some attacks. Actually, it's stated in their docs that they cannot even, that they probably can even prevent the attack that I described before, so that it won't be possible for the operator to initiate a call from the device. But that's not for certain. They write about some measures that they undertake to mitigate this issue, but we obviously were never able to test it. I believe that SIM card that is in roaming.
Yeah. So again, I'm not saying, you know, listeners go out and do illegal things. I'm just saying for the for the sake of people who are, you know, privacy and security conscious, that might be a step for people to take, whether that's using, you know, they get a Pixel is a typical phone, and then they install Graphene OS, and then they might use an eSIM, and as you said, be restrictive about what apps they install on that phone, then I guess those are sort of the basic steps that get you a phone that's a little bit more secure, let's say, than the typical phone, but with, let's say, reduced functionality, and maybe it won't be as slick and easy to use compared to, obviously, other phones.
I think that the most important thing is to actually understand your security requirements rather than trying to incrementally add privacy features to your life. Like, understand your actual threat model.
Okay, but in that case, let's say, how would you tune it then, in a way? So if the idea is, okay, you have to first understand, which I agree with you, you have to first understand what's your security model, what's your privacy threat model, how would you then tune that, like, depending on what you're worried about or trying to protect against, what kinds of actions, you know, would you, what levels would you go to?
For example, if you're a high net worth, worth individual, you probably should be very careful about the information about your private life, for example. So Graphene OS, yes, it's very good for you. Having a roaming data account, yes, it's very good for you. Probably it's enough for this use case. Of course, if you are a foreign spy or, I don't know, some critically, or maybe you're a whistleblower in some foreign country that doesn't like whistleblowers, the security requirements are, of course, much, much higher. You should be conscious about the hardware that you use, that if you just change the seller account, the new account can be linked to your old account if you use the same mobile phone, because every mobile phone has an IMEI identifier that it sends all the time, even if there is no SIM card in it at all. And you might be safer if you take care of your location habits, because a person can be identified by the routes, how he travels every day, quite precisely. So it really depends on your use case.
Back to the show in a moment. Are you still using a plain old block explorer? Mempool.space is the next generation leading blockchain explorer. You can see the mempool, you can see the blockchain, and you can even see second layer networks like the Lightning Network. You can see the mining dashboard and see all kinds of statistics around mining and mining pools. With mempool.space, you can use it to target your fee for your transaction. Whether you are looking to get into the next block, you can pay the high transaction priority, or you can put it a little bit lower and go for the medium transaction or medium priority transaction fee. So it's a great tool that you can use to help target your fee. And Wiz and the team have announced they've got a new product coming out. It's called the Transaction Accelerator. So if you find yourself in a pinch and you need to quickly accelerate your transaction, this is something that will be coming out soon. So keep an eye out for this. It's being built by the team. Otherwise, go and check out the site over at mempool.space. For listeners in or near Europe, Plan B Forum Lugano is coming up October 20th and 21st. Lugano is a city in Switzerland where they are taking Bitcoin seriously. You can pay Bitcoin and Lightning at hundreds of merchants around town. This includes restaurants, cafes, bars, clothes stores, barbershops, hairdressers, watch stores, and more. I actually have friends in town who are doing this right now. They can go there, they can spend Lightning right now, but of course they've got this forum coming up, and this would be a perfect opportunity for those of you who want to come along and meet awesome Bitcoiners, and there will be amazing speakers there, people like Nick Szabo, Adam Back, Paolo Arduino, Prince Philip, Giacomo Zucco, and so many more. There'll be multiple stages there, a main stage and a Lightning and peer-to-peer stage, where there will also be masterclasses where Bitcoiners can learn skills relating to self-custody or multi-sig. So go and check it out over at planb.lugano.ch. That's Plan B Forum on October 20th and 21st. And now back to the show. I see. Yeah. And I guess that's why some of the settings are locked down and things like this on some of these operating systems like Graphene OS. I'm curious how you are seeing some of the other competitors in that space, whether it's Calyx OS or some of these others out there. How do you view the competitors to Graphene OS?
Most of our users use Graphene OS. It seems to be the most robust, the most supported. Cannot really speculate on the alternatives.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. And so then, yeah, I guess at the end of the day, there's certain things that you just, if you're using a phone at all, it's probably just a difficult thing. I understand there are some people out there who are taking it to that level where maybe they don't even have a phone. I know people like Janine, J9 Rome has mentioned before that she doesn't even use a phone. Like she just does it all off a computer device to be more, you know, extra privacy conscious. But of course, there is more difficulty associated with all these things, right? And even with using the likes of Graphene OS, maybe it's a little more difficult to use some of these services that require location. Like as an example, it might be a little more difficult to use, let's say, Uber or things like this. So if you're traveling around, maybe that's a little more difficult. Although I've heard people will use the web app version as an example for Uber. So that's one example there. And I guess where things are going in terms of eSIMs, I'm curious, obviously you're in the industry, so you probably have a better view of this than I do, but it seems like there's a slow but gradual shift towards eSIMs in general, like not just for, you know, users of Silent.Link, but even just normal telco users are being pushed in the direction of using eSIMs. Is that the trend that you are seeing, or do you see it like physical SIMs are here to stay for some time?
No, of course, definitely plastic SIMs makes no sense anymore. And they take a lot of place in the devices, so the manufacturers are very happy to kind of ditch them completely.
I see. And then does that have any implications for you and for your service, or it doesn't really matter? It just means like actually it's probably less friction for somebody to now switch and use something like Silent.Link or any other eSIM provider?
Unfortunately, at the moment, only premium phones have eSIMs, but the trend is definitely in the direction of completely replacing physical SIMs with eSIMs in old hardware.
I see. So I guess at the lower end, the devices will still have physical SIMs, and that's where it'll still stay for some time until, let's say, the more premium devices, until, you know, and maybe that will be some time, you know, until, let's say, most people on Earth can afford a premium device, whereas, let's say, today, maybe the Western countries and the rich people in poorer countries can afford the premium phones.
I do not consider an eSIM as a premium feature. It's not like an expensive camera. So it will be absolutely everywhere.
Yeah. And so when it comes to that, then, what about locking of phones? So do you need an unlocked, I presume you need an unlocked phone in order to use Silent.Link or these eSIM services, because a lot of other phones might be carrier locked, right?
Sure. You have a carrier, you would need a carrier unlocked phone, definitely.
Yeah. But I suppose that would be reasonably common nowadays. And then for probably privacy focused users, they might be buying a secondary phone as their privacy phone or burner phone, let's call it. And maybe for that, that's where, you know, I've seen discussion online, people might use the likes of a Pixel, like the Pixel line, the 6, you know, the 6A or the 5A, or that A line is a like a budget version. So I hear that's a common one that people do, is they get the Pixel like 6A or whatever the latest A, 6A, 7A, whatever the latest one is, they'll use that one as just a low cost device that they install Graphene and then get an eSIM. So that's my understanding of how, you know, some privacy enthusiasts are going about this currently.
They might even go as far as having two phones, like one Pixel that they use them as their handheld device, and the other Pixel that works as a mobile router that actually carries our eSIM. It makes some sense, and you can swap the second, maybe less expensive phone more often, and this way you avoid tracking by IMEI identifier.
I see. So I guess at some level, though, like in that example, let's say you have your KYC phone and your quote-unquote non-KYC phone.
No. It's the first one is not KYC phone. The first one is just a phone without a SIM card.
Oh, I see.
It does not connect to the cellular network. It connects through the second phone that works as a personal hotspot.
Kind of shields
the main phone from the cellular network.
Gotcha. So it's sort of like a proxy for your phone almost. Okay. So yeah. Okay. So it's more like you have two phones and maybe the premium phone is just connecting to the Wi-Fi that's being produced or created with the mobile hotspot of the cheaper, smaller phone, let's say, or not smaller, but you know what I mean? The phone that's actually connecting through, you know, the eSIM service. And I guess that's one way to sort of get around some aspects of it. But I guess where people might fall down is, as an example, they have to be careful what services they would log in on. Because once you log into a service, let's say whether it's, you know, Gmail or Facebook or something like this, that's again where things can get tied again. You can tie your real world identity to maybe your location or what you're doing or what you're searching. So I guess that's another area that people have to be mindful of, right?
Of course, if they identify themselves, then we cannot help with that.
Yeah.
The other feature that easily identifies a mobile user is talking over legacy phone calls.
Yeah.
That's why we had initially disabled the outbound calling feature. Actually, it was one of the reasons why we did it. We may enable it in future products, but still the recommendation is to not talk over the phone, over legacy phone calls, because the equipment to fingerprint users by voice was deployed to most mobile networks more than 10 years ago. So you could expect this equipment to work very well and to be able to identify anyone with several seconds of their voice.
I see. And so in some cases, you might still need an inbound call, or you might have the option of having an inbound call for some services. Maybe they want to do like an OTP that's done over a phone call. Is that something people can use your identity eSIM for? Or is it more like you can't do that and you need to use the SMS function for that?
No. We have inbound calls activated on these accounts, so you can activate over text or over a voice call.
I see. Yeah, but it's just the outbound calls that are stopped. Okay, understood.
Yes.
Yeah, so could it be that if there's a lot of people using this kind of service, could that then create more suspicion for users of this service?
No, I don't think so, because the user of our service looks like a roamer from, say, Poland. So you cannot think that all the roamers from Poland are suspicious and disable them.
Right, yeah, because many of them would just be legitimate, you know, travelers or whatever.
Sure, it could happen on some networks. For some reason, they start blocking users that were kind of roaming in their networks for several months or more. This happened, but very, very rarely. And all they had to do is just change the eSIM and they're good to go again.
I see. Is there any recommendation about cycling between eSIM, between data-only eSIMs? Like, is it something that people should be refreshing every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, like having a new one?
We don't mind, but actually it's completely up to their security or privacy requirements. So mileage may vary.
Yeah. And for some users, I guess the security part of this might also play into, obviously, if they're a Bitcoin user, they want to be careful or cautious in terms of how much they keep on that device in a hot online connected device. And that's where often the recommendation about using hardware devices and hardware security, hardware wallets, etc., can come in. Because, you know, if we're talking about exploits and things that people are trying to protect themselves against, then maybe that's another area where people want to be cautious about the private keys to any Bitcoin wallets that are, let's say, living on that device. Maybe that's also another aspect where people want to think about, okay, how much Bitcoin am I going to keep on this device, quote unquote, on this device? What we really mean is the private keys for that Bitcoin or the access to spend. But maybe that's another thing to consider. And then maybe for the larger amounts, that's where people use hardware devices to secure, obviously, larger amounts of Bitcoin.
Actually, a Pixel with a Graphene OS is a pretty good wallet solution because you can create multiple user accounts with Graphene OS, and each one of them is can be encrypted. So when you log in into another account, you can disable network access to this account, and it can be considered as an air-gapped, not completely air-gapped, but at least offline wallet.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree with that. I mean, the air gapping part is meant to mean like no internet or no internet connectivity, but I think I would say it's probably more secure than the non, you know, graphene version of that phone, and has more security features, right? Like it has this Titan chip as well. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that Titan chip and any security that's added there.
That's the best we have at the moment, definitely. And actually, yeah, as I said, it's a pretty good solution for a wallet. So I wouldn't trust my life savings to it, but as a wallet for like medium amounts, it's much better than almost anything you can imagine in a mobile device.
Yeah, okay. And so I guess in the age of increased surveillance, right, like this, obviously the recent news with the French government wanting to give French police the right to basically spy and take geolocation of users, where do you see all that going? Do you see that that's going to get worse around the world, like that other countries will also try to bring the same functionality in, or that it already exists in various other countries?
Always has been. They always could listen to your calls. They always knew your location. It was from day one. It was kind of designed this way.
I see. Well, I guess maybe in this case, I mean, certainly I'm not disagreeing with you there. Of course, cell tower triangulation and that has been around for a long time. I think maybe what's specifically being spoken about in this case is activating certain features that already are on that phone. So, for example, activating the camera, activating the microphone, and the GPS on that phone when we already, as you are saying, as you correctly say, things like cell tower triangulation have already been around for a long time.
Yes, and triangulation is enough to track location, so GPS is not actually needed that much, especially when you can surveil for a person for a prolonged time.
Yeah.
One thing to add about the Graphene OS as a wallet, there is a very good choice of secure mobile wallets for that work on Graphene. For example, Samurai Wallet is kind of one of the industry standards in Bitcoin security.
Right, and as I understand that with Android, there are... Okay, so from what I've heard with phone development... now, you tell me if I'm getting any of this wrong, but as I understand with, let's say, the Apple line and with the premium Androids, they have chips and things that can give you additional security, whereas, let's say, the lower-cost Android devices maybe don't have that level of security. And so I'm curious if you're aware of instances where, let's say, Android wallet developers are able to use that, let's say, the Titan chip as part of the device security.
Yeah, we have Titan only in Pixels, and we have Graphene OS work only on phones with Titan chips. So we are kind of stuck with Pixels at the moment.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, certainly there are concerns about, obviously, you know, privacy, fundamental liberties and things like this that are happening around the world where, you know, people who are not doing crimes, that they merely want to not be treated as a criminal by default, which is how, sadly, some governments are, or many governments around the world are treating people. And so that's where some of these privacy tools and security tools and techniques can come in. And I think what's interesting as well is they will often have this rhetoric, that, and you see it in the news articles or in the press releases, they'll say things like, oh, we're only going to do this only for a small number of people who, you know, let's see what some of the wording. They say, oh, it's quote unquote, when justified by the nature and seriousness of the crime and quote unquote, for a strictly proportional duration, right? And they say, oh, okay, it's only going to be a few dozen cases per year. But of course, this is how many of these things start. They get a foot in the door, and then from there, it just expands on and on as people like Edward Snowden who have helped expose this kind of illegal surveillance that was going on. And I think that's sadly going to be a continuing trend with what's going on around the world. I'm curious if you have any thoughts or reactions to add there.
Yes, of course. First, they say these things, and then you find out they leaked kind of everything, more than you could even imagine. This is the normal route of operation.
Another common issue that comes up here is people, governments, or even corporations can say, oh, we're going to use some of this data for our own analytics, but don't worry, they're going to anonymize the data. And then later it comes out that some researcher or someone else has found a way to actually de-anonymize the data from, let's say, a few data points that they were able to then figure out, oh, actually, based on what I, you know, did some analytical research and I found out, based if I knew these two or three things, I could basically pin it down to an individual or pin it down with a reasonable level of certainty about who that person was or maybe where they live or where they work or something like this. And so it's another thing that people have to be wary about is that rhetoric, that line of, oh, don't worry, we'll anonymize the data and keep you safe that way. But in practice, it doesn't happen like that. And in practice, it ends up being accessible and de-anonymizable, let's say, if that's a word. Or people are able to de-anonymize.
Sure, they just leak it before it was anonymized.
Well, yeah, maybe.
After it
yeah,
was
maybe
collected.
That's another way as well, on top of the clever analytical ways that might be out there. So I'm curious, some listeners may be listening and thinking, well, look, I've just got my standard, you know, KYC phone with all my, you know, KYC'd stuff. How would it work then accessing some of the services that they would need to? Would you say they could use like a two-phone approach, or is it more like, you know, they're just going to have to lock down certain functions and you only use that stuff on, let's say, a desktop computer where they need to, and then have the phone as a more private device? Do you have any tips or recommendations for people out there?
Well, people have completely different use cases. We have a lot of users that do not care about the privacy issues that yep. much, but they use our service out of the convenience of being able to pay with Bitcoin.
And that's a great reason for having it to begin with. I mean, full stop, right? Like, just being able to pay with Bitcoin obviously means there's less trading around or having to off-ramp or having to sell some Bitcoin for cash to then be able to pay phone bills with that. So, I mean, it's useful just in that sense.
So tinfoil hat is not mandatory to use our service.
Right, yeah. Yeah, of course, yeah. And certainly, I mean, the convenience factor is there if you are traveling and let's say you've just gotten off the plane and you need to be able to get online and check your emails and things like this without paying, you know, sky-high roaming costs. So those are certainly, there's that use case also, the traveling, tourist, businessman use case. So, yeah.
Sure, and since there are no recurring fees and the balance does not expire, you can just keep it in your phone in case you need it.
Yeah, that's certainly a useful factor as well, because I think people have seen these stories of, let's say, you know, maybe a child was using their parents' phone and it was roaming and they ran up a, you know, multi-$1,000 bill and they come back from the holiday or the travel trip and now they're like, what? I just got this massive bill. I wasn't expecting it. So I guess that's one way that you can sort of pay what you know and then make sure you switch to using the eSIM in your phone so that you're not paying the roaming fees and you're instead using the eSIM fee. And you restrict the amount that you're actually paying to, let's say you charge it with $20 worth or something, then that's the amount that you're on the hook for, let's say, or that you've already paid.
Well, those are roaming fees too, but they are the minimum roaming fees. They're greatly optimized roaming fees. They are several times, maybe magnitude, order of magnitude less than normal roaming fees from major operators.
Yeah, gotcha. So I guess, yeah, so it's interesting that there's two big uses, right? It's one is the convenience factor, and then for other people, it's the privacy factor. So, you know, whatever people want, they can, I guess they can get what they need. It's like Rorschach test. You see what you need, you see what you want out of it. So, okay. So I think those are probably the key points. Do you have any updates or anything else that you wanted to share before we close up?
Well, we will be offering new plans. We already rolled out a Data Plus plan from a new provider that seems to be much more reliable. And we encourage our users to switch to this new provider or maybe have two SIMs from both providers in their phones. This way they will achieve 100% reliability. We will also be rolling out a new service for 8 OTP codes very soon. And we will also start a discussion group on our metric server so that our users will be able to share their privacy and security practices and discuss their use cases. And hopefully it will help them raise their operational security to the absolutely new level.
Great. Oh, one other question, actually, just about on-chain or Lightning. I'm curious, as a Lightning, you know, Lightning-enabled service, what's your experience been like using Lightning?
Lightning is very good for us, definitely. Actually, we enabled it from day one, and now I cannot even understand how a Bitcoin merchant could live without Lightning. It's very, very convenient in payments, and also submarine swaps are absolutely great. This is the best way to break the connection between your kind of income and your spending. Very, very convenient, and I think that any Bitcoin merchant will have to run a Lightning node, and the clever ones will run nodes themselves. It's not that difficult. Not that difficult.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I mean, I certainly encourage people to take their financial self-sovereignty into their own hands, whether that's Bitcoin on chain or Lightning. And certainly when you're running your own BTC Pay or, you know, using your own Lightning node, it's certainly a new level of sovereignty that you've got. And as you mentioned, using submarine swaps, that's an example where, let's say, you have Lightning channels and people are paying you. And then, let's say, after the week, you've received all this Lightning money, and then you need to periodically flush some of that back out and take some of that on chain. Then that's where maybe you might use the submarine swap provider. You pay them Lightning and they can pay you on chain somewhere else. And so then that's, as you mentioned, you can sort of separate out the connection from what you've received to what you are spending later on. So that's also interesting there. So I think that's probably the key points. Hopefully, you know, that's been interesting for listeners. And yeah, you can find silent.link on the web at silent.link. And thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Get the show notes at stefanlevera.com/492. If you liked the show, make sure to give it a thumbs up on YouTube, a 5-star on Spotify, a good rating, or share it with your family and friends or on social media so other people can find the show. Thanks for listening, and thanks for helping me out. I'll see you in the Citadels.